Ellen Elias Borsach, welcome to Worldviews.
Nice to be here.
So, Ellen, you've done a lot of work in translating written works from Croatian, Bosnian, Serbian. But let's start with from the beginning, kind of what took you to Croatia? That's where you went, you said, as an undergrad, as you were telling me earlier. You went there as an undergrad. So what took you there to begin with and then kind of made you stay and work in the region?
Well, it's a funny story. It was the Cold War in the early 70s when I was in college, and there were several of us, four of us in the Russian department studying Russian as our major, who wanted to go to a Slavic-speaking country and do some Russian study and learn a second Slavic language. And our professors were fiercely Cold War anti-Soviet Russians who didn't want us to go to Russia, and they were very uncomfortable with the idea of us going to a communist country. So they suggested we could go to Munich to start study Russian at Radio Free Europe, where they had a course and we could drink beer and have a fun time and come back. And we explained that we weren't interested in that and that we wanted a truly academic, serious program that we could actually do good work with Russian. And we were also interested in learning more about contemporary Soviet Union things because we all wanted to work in the area, and these professors wouldn't teach us anything after 1917. So we asked them to look further, and they found a program in Zagreb that was at the time funded in part by the State Department of the United States. And so it was a good deal. We didn't have to pay too much to go on it, and it was actually terrific. We got to Zagreb University. We took Russian courses. We also learned Croatian, or Serbo-Croatian, as it was at the time, or Croato-Serbian, as you care, anybody cares to call it. And I sang in a chorus, and in the chorus I met a young man whom I liked. And I went back to McAllister at the end of my year, got my degree, and went back to Zagreb, and we got married, and I lived there for 16 years until 1990, just before the war broke out. And everybody always asks me, so did you know the war was going to break out, and that's why you moved back to the States? And of course, I didn't. But we'd been planning for a number of years for our daughter to spend high school years in the States, and so that was really what was, it was all internal things that were governing our choices, I think, really much more than all the stuff that later became apparent.
You know, we talk about these languages as being different, Croatian, Serbian, Bosnian, Macedonian, I mean, you know, as different languages, but yet you said you studied Serbo-Croatian. And the other ways in which you call Serbo-Croatian. But so what are the distinctive differences? I mean, you're now a translator translating this work. What are the distinctions that we can point to in these languages?
Well, the simple fact of the matter is that the countries that emerged from what was Yugoslavia after the war chose to call the language that was spoken in their community by their national names. So Serbs refer to the language spoken in Serbia as Serbian. Croats refer to the language spoken in Croatia as Croatian, and Bosnians, the Bosnian government refers to the language spoken in Bosnia as Bosnian. And whether or not these overlap as languages linguistically is not that important to the people who decide what to call the language. I wrote a textbook with a colleague, Ranelle Alexander of Berkeley, where we decided to produce the textbook in such a way that every exercise is given in all three, Bosnian, Croatian, and Serbian, and the idea being to so that students could see what the similarities and differences are. There are differences, but the languages are, I would say, probably 90% mutually understandable. That doesn't mean that if you've learned Croatian and you go to Serbia, that what you'll be speaking will be the same as what the people are speaking in Serbia, but the people in Serbia will be able to understand you. And that's a piece that's a little bit hard to grasp. We have perhaps in some ways greater differences among dialects in the United States. I think there's a little bit less comprehensibility between somebody from New England and somebody from Mississippi than there is between Croats and Serbs, but maybe not. I mean, I suppose it would depend on where. And there are dialects within Croatian that are very difficult for people to understand from other regions.
Well, this has always fascinated me, having, again, spent some time there, especially given that long history of where they all, you know, were basically part of the same country and speaking, I guess 90% of their language probably is similar. Those who I would talk to about this would say, you know, they all read the same magazines, the same newspapers. Mm-hmm. They were listening and watching the same, you know, television shows. And so there wasn't an emphasis on the differences in the language until after the war, and then the various wars, and then there was a significant amount of attention that was paid to the differences in their languages. And in fact, when I was living in Skopje, Macedonia, they would have public service announcements, for example, that would say, in Serbian, this is said this way, and in Macedonian, it's said this way. It was almost like your daily, you know, lesson on how to say something in a different language and making those distinctions. It's interesting.
Well, there's quite a lot of difference between Macedonian and Serbian. I mean, Macedonian and Slovenian within the former Yugoslavia and Albanian and Hungarian and Italian were all considered languages that were distinct from the Serbian, Croatian, Bosnian, Montenegrin body of material that we think of that used to be called Serbo-Croatian or Croato-Serbian. So Macedonian, I mean, there's a lot of shared vocabulary between Macedonian and Serbian, but the grammatical structure is very different. The syntactical structure is very different. Bulgarian, it's like English. It's a language with a different logic, morphological logic. So it and syntactical logic or syntagmatic logic. So it has some really significant. I mean, I don't want to go into that here, but it has a lot of it has a but vocabulary wise, they are very close. So it's the comprehension is possible, but the differences are there, and I think that could be said certainly between Croatian and Serbian. Bosnian is kind of it goes to both sides. There are similarities between Bosnian and Croatian. There are similarities between Bosnian and Serbian parts that they share.
That's interesting. I mean, I think it was more of the vocabulary that they were trying to suggest. You know, this word, how this word might be pronounced or said in some place, more so than the grammatical construction of the language. And of course, we're also dealing with different alphabets too, right? I mean, you've got the Cyrillic alphabet being used in one part of the country.
The thing that's confusing about Serbian is that they use both the Serbian and the Latin alphabet in Serbian. And you'll see writers who choose to only have their work published in the Latin alphabet and other ones who insist on the Cyrillic alphabet. And you have people who feel, you know, passionate about not letting Cyrillic be done in by the internet. For example, I have a friend who's very fierce about that. So there's lots of different feelings about that. But in Belgrade, you'll find both. In Croatia, you don't find Cyrillic anymore at all. In Bosnia, only in the Serbian parts of the Republika Srpska will you find Cyrillic. They don't use it anymore.
So as a translator then, as you're reading these works in the original language, in the Croatian or Serbian or Bosnian, how do you capture some of those feelings, as you suggest, feelings about how something is written, what alphabet it's using, the kind of message perhaps that they're trying to convey? I mean, it does that have to come into your mind as a translator of this work?
If I felt that the... That a writer was taking a stand on something, I might mention it in an afterword about the translation. I might give it as context about the translation, but it wouldn't come up in the translation itself. When I'm working into English, a lot of these points are just moot. They're just the way people talk, and I'm finding a way to say what they're saying in English. And so I don't really have to spend too much time worrying about those nuances, unless they come up as an issue in the text itself and it's being articulated, then of course I'd articulate it.
And that would be obvious to you, I mean, as you're reading the work in the foreign language. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the work that you've translated. You've focused on translating a work about the War Crimes Tribunal. I mean, this is one of the things that, of course, many of us know about the former Yugoslavia, is that it was one of the first efforts to use a War Crimes Tribunal to hold accountable those responsible for, you know, massive atrocities in the country during those wars. So what is it that you did in that area, and how was it that you were able to communicate to an English-speaking audience what it is we need to know about the War Crimes Tribunal?
Well, first, I should say that what I am principally is a literary translator. I mostly translate literature. After the war, first in 1998 and then off and on until 2005, when I went for 5 years, I was working as what's known as a reviser at the War Crimes Tribunal in the language unit. And there are two main jobs for translators at an organization like the War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague. It's called the International Criminal Tribunal for the Former Yugoslavia. It's semi-official name. And the language unit was divided between interpreters working in the booth doing simultaneous interpreting for the actual courtroom sessions and And I was not doing that. That's not my expertise. But I was working in the document area where we were preparing evidentiary material that had originally been in one of the languages of the former Yugoslavia for tendering as evidence in the courtroom. And so there was a lot of written evidence and military orders and all kinds of, I mean, millions of pages. I think that their archive is 20 million pages. I think we were translating about between 50 and 75,000 pages a year, our unit. And so my job, with four or five other native speakers of English who know the language well, was to have the original on the left, the original of whatever it was that was being translated, the document, and the translation on the right done by one of our staff members. We had 70 people working from various languages into English or into French. And then I would go along with my finger on each document and run down the page and make sure that I agreed with the judgment calls the translator had made, or wanted to give them some feedback on some of the judgment calls they'd made with how to deal with the tricky parts of the text. Of course, questions of grammar and syntax and spelling, and make sure they hadn't skipped over something by mistake and that kind of thing. And that they'd, and if there was new terminology that we had to pull from the document to add to our database, that I would then make note of that. And so we went through all the documents that were being tendered in the courtroom, and as a sort of second set of eyes, as revisers. And all of us were people like myself. I lived in Zagreb, as I said, for 16 years. And all of us were people like me who had either Americans or Brits, or there was an Irish woman, just thinking quickly through the different people I worked with, who had either taught at universities in that part of the world or lived there for a stretch of time or were married to someone, as I was, and lived there that way. So we all knew the culture well, and we could go back the pre-war years. A lot of people testifying were people who were in their 40s and 50s who'd mostly lived in Yugoslavia. The post-war period was only brief at that point, or even hadn't. We started, the tribunal started in 93, so the war wasn't even over yet when it started. But so that their vocabulary and the way they were talking about things was very familiar to all of us. Things may change. The newer generations may be using other terms in other language, but that wasn't the case for the work that we were doing.
Well, so it's interesting you bring up that kind of how language is changing and, you know, the way new things may be said or whatever. Kind of going back to this, you know, looking at, in your translation work, looking at, you know, how something is being represented and trying to pick up on that. And then you referred to judgment calls in this translation work that you get. I mean, I assume that there is always the risk you run of losing something in that translation process, I guess we use that word, a lost in translation, that there's the possibility of that, or at least, you know, making some sort of interpretation. But I guess that's, given your background and knowledge and cultural experience, that's what you're trying to grasp and understand.
What I found so interesting, of course, we are all making choices. That's what translation really is about, is many, 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 many choices in every sentence, in every vocabulary situation that you're faced with. You're weighing things and figuring out what to place emphasis on and your reading of the text and so forth. But at the tribunal, what I found so interesting is that things generally weren't lost. And that's because they were long trials. And if there was a problem with a single witness and something came up and there was confusion, the judges would turn to the interpreters in the booth and say, could you help us with this? And the interpreters would explain why they thought there was a problem. And then if there were contentious issues about terminology, which often happened because it was something much more enjoyable for some of the attorneys to talk about than the actual things that had happened on the ground that the court was there to discuss, they would prefer to sort of divert attention over to the language. And so there was a great deal of discussion of language in the courtroom. And then if there were really serious terminological issues, they would have to write a memorandum to the language unit, and we would respond formally with a memorandum about why the language unit had chosen to translate the terms as we did. And then that they were welcome to bring in a witness to contest our translation, but that we were going to stick with what we had chosen for the following reasons, and we'd usually substantiate it with either dictionaries or whatever to show why it is we had chosen to translate that way. And so in the end, it was possible for the judges to get a full understanding of all the language issues that were involved to a degree that I wouldn't have imagined possible until I actually saw it in action. But it took a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of attention to accomplish that. And of course, when one's translating a novel, one's much more limited in terms of, I mean, you just write on the paper and then a reader picks it up and reads it, and there's none of this opportunity for asking the people in the booth to explain something.
This is really instructive, actually. The notion of kind of global justice, it obviously depends on our language and use of language, and that process, that judicial process, really does, it affects it in terms of the language that's being used and how it's being said, and making sure that everyone's clear on what is being provided in terms of testimony or whatever. Very interesting, very instructive. Thank you so much, Ellen, for being with us today. Very interesting conversation. Thanks.
Thank you.